What costs money?
It's the bandwidth, basically.
This is our website.
I'm Valentina Powers. I'm an interactive producer. During breaking news stories is when most people log into our streams online.
Now let's take a look.
The more requests we get, the more we have to pay.
Help us to be there for you when you need us the most. Support podcasts by becoming a member now. Pledge online at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
Cynthia Nixon may be best known by the general public for her character Miranda Hobbs. She performed 6 seasons in Sex and the City, but she's also spent a lot of time on Broadway stages, appearing in plays like The Real Thing, Hurley Burley, Angels in America, The Women, The Heidi Chronicles, and Indiscretions. And recently, she's racked up rave reviews for her performance in David Lindsay Abaire's Rabbit Hole at the Biltmore Theater of the Manhattan Theater Club. I'm very pleased it has brought her back to my show today. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I hope it's okay to mention this since all the reviews have already given it away, but in Rabbit Hole, you play Becca, a former career woman turned full-time suburban mom who's coping with the loss of her young son. I guess there's no way to get around discussing this play without talking
yes,
about
Yes, we
that.
Tried to hide it for a while. We tried to allude to it and say it's about a family and this life-altering event has happened and they're trying to find their way back out of the rabbit hole of their lives having turned upside down. But you're right. There's really no way to talk about it without copping to what it's actually about.
In the end, it doesn't matter anyway because we figure that out fairly soon.
Within the first few minutes, I would say. Yeah.
This is your first Broadway appearance in Sex and the City went off the air. So many people think of you as Miranda. Does that sometimes get in the way of their accepting you as another character?
I don't think so. I mean, certainly there are a lot of people who only think, you know, I have blonde hair again, which is my actual own hair, and I am faced with a lot of people who say things like, wow, you've decided to go blonde. It's like, no, I've decided to go back to myself. but I think there are also a lot of certainly, particularly people who go to the theater, who remember me from
some of these other appearances
that you've mentioned.
Well, actually, this character is still a lot closer in an odd way to Miranda, what Miranda might have been if she'd gone suburban. Than Eleanor Roosevelt, the first big thing
yes,
you
I
did
think.
After
El-
you
Eleanor
left the show.
Eleanor is far more different. Eleanor is far more different, yes.
And was that a conscious thing? Let's get away as far away as possible with a character?
I mean, yes, certainly I did get offer a lot of kind of hard-hitting businesswomen and women and attorneys and stuff afterwards, and I did shy away from those. But I have to say, this play, like Warm Springs, where I played Eleanor Roosevelt, they were just both great projects. Even if they had been much closer to Miranda, I probably would have done them anyway because I just fell in love with them immediately.
And it's something that you just read the script and said, oh, I must do this?
Absolutely. And David Lindsay Abaire, who wrote the play, I have been a fan of his. I didn't know him personally, but I had seen his other plays and just thought they were amazing. And then this one is such a departure for him.
Yeah, the other ones, Fuddy Mears and Kimberly Akimbo, are more whimsical, almost goofy.
Surreal, kind of, yeah.
And both of those dealt with rare medical conditions, so their tone was general, which I guess could have been serious, but the tone was generally light. This play, despite many funny lines, is really much darker.
Yeah, and also much, it's much more like a traditional well-made play. It's much more straight ahead and spare, I think.
And relies very much on this ensemble sensibility that this incredible cast gives us. I'm assuming that Daniel Sullivan, the director, played a major role in getting you all on the same page.
Yes. I mean, I think I had sort of worked with Dan before in the Heidi Chronicles, but it was a much smaller role than I replaced, and so it wasn't a traditional rehearsal, regular rehearsal process, but yeah, we're all so in awe of him and so amazed by him. He's a He has a beard, Dan, and he says very little. So he reminds you sometimes of a Freudian analyst, except for his incredible warmth that comes out of him. But he says he likes to just keep quiet in rehearsal and watch where the actor's instincts lead them. And then when they get in trouble, then he'll come in with his pearls of wisdom, and they do seem very magical. You can just be totally lost, and he'll just say one thing to you, and everything will seem clear.
Well, did you all discuss how real people might react to a situation like
this? We absolutely did, and I think David Lindsay Baer, before he wrote the play, did a lot of reading people's case histories and books that they had written about their experience of having their children die or be killed in different ways, and we all then pored through these books and talked about people we knew and talked about whatever experiences we had had that, you know, came as close to that.
Ben Brantley has praised the production for having, I'm quoting, some of the most revealingly nuanced acting to be seen on a stage or screen this year. That's something difficult to do. How long before it came together like that?
You know, I think it starts with the play, and the play is so seemingly simple and spare, and there are a lot of silences in the play. There aren't a lot of big juicy monologues about, you know, about how I'm feeling. You know, it is so much about silences and trying to get on with the everyday stuff of life, and you keep running into this reality, and it throws you for, you know, it makes you cry, or it makes you angry, or it makes you shut down, or whatever.
But not just silences. People talk over each other a lot. And that I imagine, because it just feels so real, I imagine those timing things didn't just happen accidentally.
You know, some of them did, and then someone was smart enough to hold on to them, or sometimes we would be guided toward them. And I think it's a very good cast, and it's a combination of the cast and what David has written and Dan's flawless sense of walking this line of having it really seem like these are people who've lost the child of their family, but not lapsing into being overly dramatic or maudlin or solemn.
A number of people have said that the real trick to a good movie or a good play is first in the casting. That's what, 80% or something like that. And it seems to have been the case here. But do you know that automatically? Do you know that you and John Slattery are really going to appear to be a husband and wife? I mean, sometimes you see a play and you say, I don't believe it for a second. Those people could never have lasted as a married couple. And then you see something like this and you feel, well, gee, they've lived together for the last 10 or 15 years.
Well, John and I, we've never really worked together. He was on Sex and the City one time, but I really didn't act with him. But we've known each other for years and seen each other in a million things, and I've always loved him. And I think we instinctively knew that we would really work well together. I think our sensibilities are similar but complementary, and yeah.
Because I've always wondered about that chemistry thing that people
It's important.
About.
It's hard to fake.
It really does happen?
It's hard to fake, you know, unless you have the famous story about Deborah Winger and Richard Gere. You know, sometimes when you totally loathe the person, you can take the intensity of that feeling and let people believe that you actually love them, but just that you have big feelings about them is the main thing.
My guest is Cynthia Nixon, who is starring in Rabbit Hole, the Manhattan Theater Club production at the Biltmore Theater on West 47th Street, just off of 8th Avenue. And is this an open run?
No, we were supposed to close on March 19th, but we have extended, I think, at this point through April 9th.
Mm-hmm. And that's because the play has
it's
received the kind
very
of success.
Well, and there are people who want to see it. God, you know, knock on wood.
Well, a number of mothers have told me that they'd have a hard time seeing a play about the loss of a child. And you have a son about the same age.
I do. Both John Slattery and I have sons. Well, the boy in the play was 4, and my son is 3, and his son is 5. So
you've split the difference.
Yes.
Very
yes.
Solomonic.
Yes.
Does that make it harder for you at times? Because you must think, gee, what would happen if my kid had died that way.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. It's your job to try and think about that and imagine that. I mean, I think it makes it harder and easier, you know. I mean, you have a point of reference. You don't have something tragically having happened to your child, but you understand the place that your child has in your life, and you can at least potentially imagine what that would be like if that child wasn't there anymore.
Do you think this play is mainly about the various stages of grief after the first shock is worn off?
I think it's about, I mean, as I said, we've all read a lot of these books, and the death of a child is an almost unimaginable thing, and, you know, everyone says life just doesn't make sense anymore, and the idea that your child predeceases you is so, you know. But at a certain point, you do have to make a choice, and you have to decide to be, you know, buried under the weight of it, or you have to go on. And I think the play is so much about going on with your life, but with this central defining event that has happened that will never go away, that lives inside you and colors everything that happens to you and every decision that you make after that.
But different for different people involved. Howie, your husband, grieves differently than your character Becca does. And ironically, he works in risk management. He manages to convey a sense of outward calm and affability, but then as we watch him, we realize his incredible anger that he's holding in. You seem angrier at first, but then you find a different way of dealing with the loss.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's an event like this. It's just not linear, and nothing is expected, and there is no straight line from A to B. And you're doing well one day, and the next day you're slapping somebody in a supermarket. I mean, there's no discernible pattern to it.
Well, in real life, as I understand it, a huge percentage of the couples who have a loss like this wind up getting divorced.
80%, and you know, it's so. Again, the books that I've read and the people that I've spoken to, that often people think, well, you're a couple, you're together, you shared this child, the loss of this child is similar, at least you have each other to console. And at least at the beginning, everyone says it's just completely untrue. It's as if one of you was crippled and then the other of you was crippled, and you each need each other to help walk, but as soon as you lay any weight on the other person, they just collapse. Mm-hmm. And that also...
But also everybody is blaming
everybody,
himself on some
level. And it's very hard, whatever circumstances your child dies in, whether there is blame to go around or not, it is very hard not to feel guilty and blame yourself, and not to feel angry and blame other people.
As the play opens, Becca learns that her flaky, unmarried sister, Izzy, is pregnant. Mary Catherine Garrison is just wonderful.
She's amazing, isn't she? But
that has to be a difficult situation for a grieving parent every time you hear that somebody else is going to have a child.
Particularly, right, when you're I think the thing that we have in the play is that I'm the daughter who's always done everything right, and she's the daughter who's always done everything wrong. And one of the many things that I did right and well is I had this wonderful little boy that everybody doted on, and now he's gone, and now Izzy's having one, and Izzy, who could never do anything right, everyone is so hungry for a child, and I can't help but feel that this is a substitute child that's supposed to erase the memory of my child and take his place.
And in that scene, we see Becca folding a laundry basket full of little boys' clothes. It takes a while for us to realize that they belong to the child who's no longer in the picture. How much do you decide on simple things like how do I fold them, how carefully, how much attention do I call to doing this kind of business, and how much do I have to worry about the people in the last row of the balcony?
I think that when you lose a child, every single thing that catches your eye and every thought that passes through your mind, at least for a long time before you can start to think about anything else and start to come out of the shock of it, I think everything is about your child and a memory of them or the fact that they're not there. And so you cannot possibly give in to all those feelings, or you would just sit there immobilized. And so I have an awareness, you know, of folding the clothes, but that it's a very... you know, I don't sit there and cherish the clothes and, touch them gently as I'm going through them. You couldn't possibly do that. I mean, I think there is something about Becca that she is very organized and very, you know, she keeps a good house and she's very proud of it. And it's one of her defenses for trying to keep herself together.
I guess I was asking you, how conscious are you of this? Last year, I think, I had Meryl Streep here, and I praised her for something I'd seen her do on stage many years ago. She's playing a very nervous character, and she opened a candy, the cellophane wrapper on a candy or a cough drop, and popped it in her mouth, and we were very aware of just how much tension there was in her. Uh-huh. And she said, oh, I remember that. I had a sore throat at the time, and I needed a cough drop.
Right.
And I had thought, gee, what a brilliant
piece of
business.
But I'm sure that there was a way that, like you say, that
she did it in character
still. That she did it in character, yeah.
Would it be different if you'd played that scene for TV or for the movies?
I think there is a little more, when you act on film, you act a little more with your eyes and your face, you know, and there is a lot more acting with yourself almost when you're on because your acting partner on stage is the other performer, and on film, really, your acting partner is the camera.
But we're very aware of body language when you're on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of these characters tells us an awful lot about just by how they're sitting or standing.
Yes, yes.
Tyne Daly plays your mother, and she has many of the funniest lines, including a hilarious riff on the so-called Kennedy curse. Now, she's also a veteran stage actress now, better known by the general public for her TV work. Do you think that helps in any way, the fact that you've had that kind of shared experience?
The television?
Mm-hmm.
I suppose. I mean, we're just also, you know, I'm such a fan of hers, and I mean, I saw Gypsy twice. I just thought it was the greatest thing ever. I listened to it all the time, and in addition
she made
to,
us forget Ethel Merman.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. She's just amazing. And certainly I've seen her in her television work too, and I think we're a couple of broads who've been around for a long time, you know. I think we have a certain fellow traveler feeling.
Well, you've been around a long time because you started so young. The sets by John Lee Beatty are amazingly detailed, and also they move and they revolve between scenes. Often you're walking up the stairs as the set is moving.
Yes.
Did that get tricky?
No, you have to. It's like being on a ship. You have to learn how to brace yourself and know that it's a certain way when it takes off and a certain way when it stops, and it can be a little jerky. But people talk to us about that all the time, about loving to watch the set move and also loving to watch people move through the house. It really gives you a sense that it is a real house and we are inhabiting it, which is, I think, is so useful.
It has a ceiling.
Yes.
So many shows don't have ceilings.
And a beautiful ceiling.
Cynthia Nixon is here. She's appearing in Rabbit Hole at the Manhattan Theater Club at the Biltmore Theater on West 47th Street. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Cynthia Nixon, who is starring, along with Mary Catherine Garrison, John Slattery, Tyne Daly, and John Gallagher Jr., in a fabulous new play by David. What? Now I've suddenly lost his
David
name.
David Lindsay Abair.
Lindsay Abair, and it's directed by Daniel Sullivan at the Manhattan Theater Club, Biltmore Theater on West 47th Street, just off of 8th Avenue. A listener said she just loved you as Eleanor Roosevelt and wanted to hear a little bit about how you researched and prepared for that role. Do you research for all the roles you do, or are you one of these people who just trust the script when you can?
I don't usually research for the role. I don't know if I've been researching things lately because I'm getting older and wiser, or they're just roles that lend themselves to research. I mean, certainly when we did Warm Springs, Margaret Nagel, who wrote the script, had, again, thoroughly researched and just started, as soon as I was cast, she just started sending me books. And there were so many documentaries on Eleanor and on the two of them. And I started with Blanche Weisen Cook's two-volume
amazing
biography. Amazing.
But and you don't want to do imitations. You don't want to do the Rich Little version.
No, you don't want to do the Rich Little version. But when you're playing someone that everyone knows what she looks like, and even more importantly in her case, everyone knows what she sounds like, you want to at least evoke that person. And I went to the Museum of Television and Radio, and I watched lots of footage with her, and I tried to get a sense of, because the tough thing, and Kenneth Branagh felt this too, about what we have from Eleanor and Franklin is they made so many public appearances and they made so many stirring speeches, but trying to imagine what they were like off the podium. So I looked for her on talk shows when she would be a little more relaxed and a little more at home and a little more like her at-home self.
She also did a radio show on the station. Did you know
that?
Yes,
I do.
You grew up in New York and Manhattan, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, I did.
And were a child actor. At what age did you begin working professionally?
Like 11 or probably 11, 12, I would say.
How old were you when you were in Little Darlings?
I was 12 and I turned 13 during it.
And then you appeared that same year in the Philadelphia Story?
No, I appeared in the Philadelphia Story when I was 14. Ah. So that was a year and a half or so later.
In those days, did people tell you that you needed to choose between careers in television, film, or theater? Or did you not? Was it just all just fun and play?
You know, I started when I was 11 or 12, and I didn't do my first play till I was 14, which doesn't sound very long. But at the time, it really... it was very different when I did my first play, because I was a kind of a quiet kid, and I was very internalized, and having only done a film, I was really taught to, as I was saying before, act with my eyes and act with my face, and it was really a lesson about getting on stage and using your body and using your voice. And I kept coming home and showing my mother what they were having me do, and I kept saying, isn't it too much? And she was like, no, it's good, because we were at the Beaumont. It's a very big house.
But still, that internalizing is not a bad thing.
It's
what leads to that miracle that we see only with really good actors, where it appears that she's thinking that line at that very moment, hasn't memorized it for months by now. That is that special thing that occurs when somebody just becomes the character.
But you do have to find a way when you're on stage. You have to find a way to still have it be internalized, but have it, you know, carry over the footlights.
And you were pro all the way into college. You did ABC After School specials, Prince in the City, Amadeus. And weren't you a freshman at Barnard while you were appearing on Broadway in two plays at the same time?
I was, in Hurley Burley and The Real Thing, that Mike Nichols directed both of them.
So how did you manage that?
Well,
I mean, forget about the homework part.
Yeah, I had done each of them separately. I had done each of them out of town. Then I had also done Hurley Burley off-Broadway. And by the time they were both running on Broadway at the same time, the actress who had taken over for me in The Real Thing left to go do a job. And so I was able to do both of them because they were only two blocks apart, the theaters. And I was in the first act of Hurley Burley and the second act of The Real Thing and the third act of Hurley Burley. So I would just travel back and forth. It was it's like doing two different characters in the same play in one evening. It was just two different characters in two different plays in two different theaters.
But did you have to drop out of school for that time?
No. No, it was my freshman year in college, and I did actually give my... I didn't do them together for that long because I'd each done them separately for so long. I think I only did them for about 3 months, and I actually did give my notice on both of them because I had a geology final my first semester, and I was very frightened of geology.
They say that television series is kind of more like theater than it is like movies. Has that been your experience?
It really depends. It's a hybrid. I think it's the more you're with a studio audience and the more you're on a kind of in a studio one set, the more it does feel like a play. I'm sure the Honeymooners, you know, felt a lot like a play. With us, it was a kind of a hybrid. It has... The thing that Sex and the City had in common with a play is kind of the importance of the words, and that the words led everything. And as in the film, you know, there are so many silences and you muck about with the words all the time, and it's really about the whole picture. But I think theater and television have this in common, that they really are both about the words.
And the ensemble feel. You just couldn't do each line separately, as you say. You just had to get that scene right.
Right, right.
At the beginning, you have any idea, I'm sure I know the answer to this, but that it would become what it
became. No, I mean, we didn't even know if we'd get picked up or anything, you know? I mean, we were just personally, I was just so happy to be on a TV series that shot in New York because I had, you know, I had always never really tried for them because they were in California and I lived in New York. But
and that was a Law & Order was it.
I had done, right, Law & Order and The Cosby Show, and there were a couple, but not many.
How much input did you have in shaping your character once the show took off?
None, really. You know, she was so great. The way she was written, she was in the book. She was in Candace's column, and she was, you know, when she started out, she was extremely acerbic and angry and scary. I would say she was scary. But funny, you know, really sharp-witted and sharp-tongued. And then over the years, she kind of, she grew more dimensions and we saw the vulnerable part of her that made her so defensive and angry and protected. But every now and again, I would say something if something didn't seem quite right. But, you know, when you have writers as good as our writers, you just let them do their thing. Anything that you're going to contribute is never going to be the level of the stuff, the level that they're thinking at.
There also, I'm sure, was a trust factor. Even if there was something you thought you might be uncomfortable with, you knew that it had worked in the past. And part of what made that show successful was that sense of outrageousness.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I always felt very, you know, in good hands and protect. And occasionally we would do stuff that they would think was too far, and then they wouldn't, you know, stuff that I would love, but they would think, they would say, no, it's too far. We can't show that.
And now there are three versions. Mm-hmm. There's the HBO version, then there's the cable version, and then there's the really cleaned up broadcast TV version.
See,
have you
I don't
watched
even,
any of them?
I don't know. Is there a difference between the cable version and the really cleaned up
yes.
one? Oh, I didn't know that, you see.
Actually, at a certain point, your kid will be able to see the last. I once asked Kelly Lynch why she had appeared in this kids' film. She said, well, I had to be in something that my kids could see me
in. That's funny.
Because they wondered, Mommy, what do you do for a living?
That's funny. Yeah.
So has your success on Sex and the City affected your choice of theater work? Because the financial security, I imagine, allows you to take on things that you might not have been able to take on at an earlier point in your life.
Yeah, I think more so it just creates a lot of opportunity, you know. Theater is such a hard sell in some ways nowadays, and I think that having people like Tyne and I, who people know from television, even though obviously we have a lot of theater credits to our name, I think it really helps. I would say it's more, not so much the financial freedom, because, you know, look, I did off Broadway plays for years and years and years and years and years for no money without a Sex and the City paycheck to back it up. But I would say it's just an opportunity. People are more, you know, they give you the job because they know you can do it, but they also give you the job because you have a certain marquee-ness to your name and people will be interested to come see for that reason.
Are you surprised at how well drama, serious theater is doing these days? There was a time a few years ago when the newspapers were filled with articles about how Broadway was dying, that it was too expensive to mount serious plays, so it was only British musicals that
yeah.
were having any success.
Well, I think we shouldn't get too rosy and too cheery about it. I mean, it's we love our play and we're very happy that we're a success, you know, but the only reason that we're able to be on Broadway at the moment, you know, to get to the point where we are a hit is because Manhattan Theater Club is doing it. And it's very, very different than producing something commercially. Between Manhattan Theater Club and The Roundabout, you know, a lot of the serious drama and, you know, serious comedy, frankly, is because of those two institutional theaters that get cut a lot of financial breaks and allow them to produce things.
You're also a founding member of a small theater company called the Drama Department.
Yes.
What do you do there?
I've done a number of plays for them. We did The Country Club. We did Kingdom of Earth. We did As Bees and Honey Drown. I Hope is the Thing with Feathers. Douglas Carter Bean and I founded it together. And we hit some bad financial times for a couple of years, and so we've been just doing a lot of benefits lately to try and get ourselves out, and now we're back in the black, and we're starting to produce again. We did a production of Rope a couple of months ago.
I was talking yesterday about how dependent the Metropolitan Opera Company is on philanthropists, and they're competing for the top opera stars with European companies that have government subsidies.
Mm-hmm.
theater has government subsidies in most of the rest of the world as well. Would you like to see that sort of thing here?
I would. I would. I mean, you know, we have the NEA, but it's certainly not like they not like the funding of the arts that they have in England and Germany and France.
You've been outspoken in other aspects of your life. Weren't you arrested a few years back outside City Hall, which is just across the street from where we are, for protesting school budget cuts?
Yes, I was. Yes, I was. And it I think it was one of many, many things that helped contributed to beating back the budget cuts of that year.
And that was before your child was even...
No, no, my daughter, it came out of the fact of my daughter's first day of... She'd already been in public school for pre-K, but then her first day of kindergarten, there were these massive budget cuts that came down, and it was her first day at a new school, and it was decimated. They lost the assistant principal and the art teacher and the music teacher and two-thirds of the paraprofessionals, which were the assistant teachers that help out in the lunchroom and the classroom and the yard. And it was just an entirely different school than the one I had toured a few months back. And a lot of us, you know, just immediately went from that first day of kindergarten with our kids in tow. We immediately started going to protests.
Did you go to the public schools in New York?
I did.
Have you thought about how much they've changed in the years since you were a student?
I mean...
We're always hearing about the schools in crisis, but I think they probably were in crisis even when you were
a kid. When I was in school, it was the 70s, and believe me, we were even more in crisis than they are now.
Have you thought about sending your kid to private school?
I haven't. I really like the public schools. I think I'm just astonished by the talent and the dedication of the teachers and all the adults who work in the schools, and I'm at the same time as I'm equally astounded by... You know, the lack of funding and the lack of money. But, my daughter, she's in fourth grade now, so this is her sixth year in public school. And every teacher she's had has been tremendous. And I'm not even talking yet about the kids. I mean, the kids in her classes are just incredible.
Well, I know I wouldn't send my kids to private school, mainly because whatever negative things I had when I went to the public schools, they made me who I am. Mm-hmm. And I think that was all right.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid of that elitist side.
I am afraid of that too. There's also, we all try and just replicate our own childhoods for our kids, I think. But you know,
correct them, make them a little better.
But when I was growing up, there just wasn't this kind of money in the city that we have now, and there wasn't. You know, there were always the people on Park Avenue and Fifth Avenue, but you know, now I just think that there's so much money that there's, there's a sense of insulation that I don't want my kids to have. I want my kids to be New Yorkers and to be in the thick of it.
My guest is Cynthia Nixon, now starring in Rabbit Hole at the Manhattan Theater Club at the Biltmore Theater on West 47th Street off of 8th Avenue. You said that this is a limited run, extended but still a limited run.
Extended at this point until April 9th, yes.
And then what? Are you one of those people who knows what you're going to be doing for the next 2 years?
No. I mean, I'm supposed to do The Prime of Miss Jean Brody for Scott Elliott at the New Group next season. And I have a few films that I'm attached to that are, you know, looking for their funding. And I have something in development at HBO. But it's all, you know, kind of nebulous at this point.
Well, if they all come together, you're one of those rare people who knows how to do that, appear in two plays at the same time.
Yes.
Has stardom also brought a negative side? I mean, now Page Six will write things about Cynthia Nixon. In the past, even if everybody thought you were a great actress in theater, you probably wouldn't have gotten the kind of attention.
Never. Yeah, I mean, I think also it's funny. You know, there is when you become known for a role, there are certain qualities of that character that people then attribute to you. And certainly on Sex and the City, our the fashion and our clothes were such a big part of that. And you know, that's not something that I really am that interested in or that good at, frankly. But now, like you say, there are paparazzi around and Page Six columnists. I do have to, you know, put some thought into what I look like when I, you know, go
well,
out.
You look fine.
Well, thank you.
But you're
obviously
not as interested in fashion as Sarah Jessica Parker, for
example. No, she's amazing at it. She's got a real talent for it.
Do you think that there's ever a possibility, I know there were rumors in the past, that we will see some kind of a movie version?
I don't think so. I think we kind of had our moment right when the show was going off the air, but now we've all kind of scattered to the winds and are all doing our own things.
I gather people even thought that you'd move to Brooklyn because Miranda moved to Brooklyn.
Right.
And also many actresses are.
Right, but I am still on the Upper West Side where I have been for many years.
If you had your druthers, would it always be theater?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that one of the, you know, English actors are really great for a lot of reasons, and one of the reasons is Shakespeare, and they have this really solid classical training. But one of the reasons that they're so good is that their country is so small, and it's all in London. And so we don't have this New York-Los Angeles split. And I just think the more strings you can have in your bow, the more versatile you are, the better an actor you are. So I certainly wouldn't want to devote myself to any one of the big three. I like doing it all, and I like doing the, you know, books on tape. I like doing everything.
Although that's changing in England as well. There was a time when you could assume that every actor came along had done Shakespeare first, been a member of some repertory theater company, but not anymore. Helena Bonham Carter and pretty much everybody who's come since started in the movies and then went back to the stage.
But at least there is this, I don't know, it's in your mind, it's in your repertoire. I mean, for us, particularly for New York actors, it's different if you're a theater actor in the regions. But if you're in New York, where are you going to do Shakespeare? Pretty much only at the Public or, you know, maybe Theater for a New City. We just don't do Shakespeare enough, particularly in this city, to have it be part of everyone's repertoire.
Do you feel that as a loss?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
How much have you done?
I have only done one. I did Romeo and Juliet at the Public. I go see it a lot, but I've only done one.
And if you had an ideal role? Is there anything like if there's a Cynthia Nixon dream project?
Oh, gosh. I would love, I mean, there are a lot of Shakespeare's I would like to do. I would like to do, you know, Catherine in Taming of the Shrew. I'd like to do all of them. I'd like to do Beatrice and, you know, I'd like to do all of them. But I would also, I have to say, I loved playing Eleanor Roosevelt so much, and she had such an amazing life, and I played her on the younger end. I played her in her 30s, and I would like to do, as I get older, I would like to do more and more chapters of her.
Well, the best roles are the villains and the people you have admired.
Yeah, yeah.
And I want to thank you so much for being with us today. Cynthia Nixon, who stars along with John Slattery, Tyne Daly, Mary Catherine Garrison, and John Gallagher Jr. in Rabbit Hole, now at the Biltmore Theater on West 47th Street. The play by David Lindsay Abaire has gotten great reviews. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
You too.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast of the Leonard LoPate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.